Hi, hello, bonjour, and namaste. This is Out of the Clouds, a podcast at the crossroads between business and mindfulness. And I'm your host, Anne Muletala. Today, I am delighted to be inviting you to embark on a journey of sorts. And the person who you are going to join on this journey is Caitlin Krause. Caitlin is a renowned experience designer, a learning expert, and an author who I had the pleasure of meeting last year, almost a year ago, when I attended TED, the conference in Vancouver. We found ourselves gathered together in a small group with a few other participants the night before the conference started, right after Esther Perel gave her welcome speech. And I found there was a lot of serendipity in the handful of people that I ended up having the pleasure to meet and talk to at this big event that I'd never attended before. I was fascinated as soon as I met Caitlin, first of all, because we share a passion in common, and that is teaching and bringing mindful practices to others, though our means are quite different. So in this conversation, we delve into the transformative power of presence and mindfulness, the equally important power of storytelling, and how these two converge in her work in immersive technologies. In our conversation, Caitlin reflects on her formative years, from embracing misbehavior and play to the profound influence of poetry, creativity in her education. She also talks about her experience living in Russia, the guidance that she was offered by her grandparents, by her mother, and shares her insights into the interdisciplinary approach that has shaped her worldview and how this informs the work that she does today. She tells me about her consultancy, Mindwise, her role as an experienced designer, and we dive into her book, Designing Wonder, only one of her books that I had the pleasure to read before our interview. Now, a lot of people know Caitlin because of her work in the metaverse, in technology, in spatial computing, in emotion mapping. So she talks us through the terminologies, definitions, and how she approaches designing experiences in these multiple realities. We end on the importance of creating safe spaces for exploration, for learning, setting intention, and the possibilities that we can have thanks to neuroplasticity. I don't believe that this will be the only conversation that Caitlin and I are going to have on this podcast. I feel there's much more that we could talk about. But I'm already incredibly proud and delighted to be bringing you this interview with someone who I find absolutely fascinating and inspiring. So without further ado, I give you my interview with the wonderful Caitlin Krause. Happy listening. Caitlin, I'm so happy to see you. Welcome to Out of the Clouds.
Thank you, Anne. It's wonderful to be here. I'm so happy to see you too.
So tell me, how am I finding you this morning and what time is it where you are?
This morning, it is almost 11 o'clock. You're finding me, I think, a mix of energized. There's a bounce. I've just finished a big project, first stage. So I feel good about that. I feel light. And I'm also feeling a deep sense of the promise of this year. I don't know how macro we want to go, but I was talking with a bunch of people last night at a Stanford event and then something afterwards. And we were saying 2024 seems to have a lot of promise in it for tech to do something good that brings people together. So that's what I'm feeling right now. Just this kind of promise, like I'm looking out at a vista and see a lot. Mm-hmm.
That's lovely. I already want to bounce off away from my questions. I heard you speak on another podcast. I can't remember the name of it. It was really a wonderful conversation about the notion of good. What does that mean to you? especially in the context of tech doing good?
The notion of good. So this is really a question that I've asked for a while, because I think that good can be construed a lot of different ways. And often when we're little, we're told to be good, and it's in contrast to misbehavior. And so sometimes this word good becomes watered down. Like, it's not great, it's just good. What does it mean? Tech for good. Good for who? I think I try not to have a strict definition, because I know a lot of people have different ways to approach it. And I'm looking because, well, I wrote a poem about it. And I think at one point we could, absolutely. I think you would really riff off this poem, and it's a lot of fun. So
if I can find it.
I feel like it would just be really interesting, because our podcast is going to go in all different directions, but I have a history as an educator. I was teaching in middle school. I was teaching in high school. Now I teach in university, and I also have a background as a programmer. So I've been in tech and education. And I think that in a lot of what I've done, I've tried to upend the narrative of people feeling like they have to behave. Because I think misbehavior can be really exciting. And it doesn't mean everyone can still treat each other with dignity. It's just, what do we take for granted that were the rules that we were told to follow? Because I think sometimes keeping everybody in line is something that doesn't necessarily lead to the most creativity and freedom. I used to do these exercises when I was in class, where I would ask students to write pieces of poetry or pieces in response. And I'd have a lot of people come into class and say, I don't do poetry, or I was told that I'm not a very good writer, or I'm not a storyteller. And I'd had students probably around the age 12 to 18 who had some previous experience in an English class or some kind of liberal arts class, and decided that it was a hard line between the creative arts and the sciences. And I used to totally break that down and not say, oh, you have to write poetry, but I would create these hooks and inroads. And then everybody would be having so much fun that it's, we just want to join in. And sometimes I think poetry is code. Poetry is programming. It's a way of looking at the world too. You can start to see a structure of a poem in a tree and then break it down and say, oh, wow, I'm noticing the world. And I start to see the in-breath and the out-breath and that kind of river moving underneath everything. And yeah, so when they would write poetry, I would write with them, or when they'd write some creative prompt at the beginning of class, it would usually be to push against something. And we had just heard a morning announcement on the loudspeaker that actually said, remember to be good today. So I was thinking, what is good? And I thought I'd just start the class in a way where I would ask the students, tell me what's good. And I've learned, Anne, that there's a trick when you want a group to engage in something, you need to engage in it yourself. Because if I were to stand and just watch them writing or hover over them, the ones who are really shy or don't have maybe the confidence to take a risk would turn with papers and say, is this good? Talk about good. Is this good? Is this what you want? Am I doing it right? And so I'd get really into it, keep my own journal and start writing on the prompt with them. And they'd see me writing and we'd all be writing. And then at the end, it was just a free-for-all where we'd share what we wrote in the limit of 5 minutes. Having a limit, it created the creative constraint where people knew that you almost can't judge each other because you only had 5 minutes. So no one was saying, oh, this is terrible. We were saying, hey, look what I could write in 5 minutes when I just let myself go. And that's how the poem amazing. Went. That's where it came from. And it doesn't really have any edits. It just came out like that.
Wonderful. That reminds me of a prompt that I found in your book, Designing Wonder. And let me see if I've pulled it here, because I know I pulled it.
That's great. No. And as you're talking, it's funny. We live in electronic worlds, and I realized right beside me, I have the book that actually has the it has the poem in it. So it's funny because we look a lot of times for pieces that are in digital, and I'm scrolling through digital and I'm writing about digital well-being. And
sometimes here's the printed copy next to you.
Yeah, the printed copy with the original is right next to me, and then it has an index in the back. And this is how we used to do things, and it's funny. It still works really well to go to paper when you have paper in front of you and it feels good. Yeah. Okay. This is the poem From Paper. And I'll just read it while you're finding things. Meditations on good. Good dog. Good morning, sunshine. Good grief. To be good, don't disturb. I'm perturbed by the word. It's absurd. Good gumdrops. Good for me is wicked Wikipedia. Symmetry, ice, everything nice. Sugar and spice. And silence after the heavy rain. Thick clutch of a net when the basketball sinks. Good is go. Red is stop. Fast or slow. Good. Someone once told me to be good, and I thought, no, fall down. It's okay if they frown. But I didn't dare act on it because I wanted the goods that good people get. Oh, regret. Good morning. Good day. Good night, moon.
I wanted to get the good that good people get. Good night, moon. That's beautiful. Hey, I'm so glad we're speaking today.
Me too. This is delightful.
All right, so let's pause and let's go back to my original starting question.
Super.
Which makes sense to go back to, because even though you've given us already a little bit of background for our listeners, I want to bring you back to how I enjoy to start conversations with my guests by asking them to tell their story. And by that, I love to ask about how and who you were as a kid, as a teenager, what you dreamt of, how you came to be the person that you are today. And it's important because we often talk so much about what we do. And I love to hear about who we are before we get into the nitty-gritty of the day-to-day. So I know it's a big question, but Caitlin, would you tell us your story?
Sure, I'd love to. Wow, I love these questions. They're so good because they peel back the layers. When I was really little, I lived by the ocean. I love that. I was born in Boston and we lived by the water near where the Mayflower landed, for people who know historical. So New England. And I love the seasons. And I used to go down to the beach and we'd watch horseshoe crabs. I was really interested in horseshoe crabs, which are one of the oldest creatures alive on planet Earth. And I just thought they looked fantastical. And this was around the time of just being enamored with Jim Henson and the Muppets. And they just looked surreal. And I remember loving being at the beach. And then we moved pretty early. And we moved overseas and I had to adjust to, my parents were in the Foreign Service. I was moving around and I was a big daydreamer when I was little. I would always look out the window, or there are kind of pictures of me daydreaming, just kind of like making up stories in my head. And I think it's because I had a lot of freedom of time to make up games and play things, and it wasn't created for me. So if we were ever, I remember just staring out the window at a rainy window on the side of a car and watching the raindrops travel across with the stream of the motion of wind. So I was always wondering how things work as a child and trying to deconstruct them, but not in an analysis sort of way, just in kind of an appreciation. And I was a big tinkerer. I remember, I think it was 4 or 5, the year I learned how to tie knots. I don't know if you can remember learning how to knot, but there are different types of knots you can tie. And then I was really big into fort building, always making forts with ropes or indoors with different blankets and pillows. Yeah. So creating worlds was very interesting to me as a little kid. And when I would dream, some of my dreams were things, a recurring dream was that when I inhaled, I could levitate. So I could fly, but it wasn't just flying. It was flying through my lungs.
That's amazing.
So I still have that dream sometimes. And it involves floating, because depending on how deeply you're inhaling, you can float versus fly in a faster way. Yeah. And I think a big moment for me too was something I connect with now being older, when I was about, again, I think it was probably 4 or 5, maybe 6. Right after my grandfather passed away, my mom's dad, I'd been close with him, and I remember not understanding really what was going on. And I started to feel a little bit like he was with the stars. And then I felt as if I was with the stars as a little kid. And I remember looking at the bathroom mirror and having this experience that was really powerful, where I looked at my face and I looked at my body, and I said to myself in the mirror, this is not all of me. This is not me. And I said, yeah, just that this is the shell or the vessel that we get to. And I didn't have the words for that, but I just knew that I had a feeling of beyond, and I had a feeling of myself being in a container where I'm grateful for it. That's life. And there was a physical and a non-physical kind of connection. And I think that's probably what, I don't know. I think it affects our life, these childhood experiences we have and remembering what's meaningful.
Of course. Is that the grandfather who used to work for NASA and build?
Yeah, that's my dad's father. And I had a longer relationship with him because he lived longer. So I used to go and spend time in the lab and go to his he worked at NASA doing research on wearables and also the tensile strength of fabrics and doing a lot of the ultrasonic bondings. That was amazing growing up, just being older and getting to experience all that science and experimentation. That's what I really love, to experiment. And he definitely impacted me. Thanks so much. And I appreciate it. My family and my origin story a little bit.
Yeah. I do. And I do think it's kind of wonderful, because as I was hearing you talk about him, I could almost feel the wonderment that a child could have having a family member that worked with the people that send the first men on the moon, right? It made me think of the lens of possibility that comes with that kind of access.
Yeah. The possibility and the dreaming that couples with the precision and the rigor, like the dreaming, and it's totally moving. And he was a person that was very playful, loved games. My grandmother did as well. And they were both mathematicians. They met in school for math. They went to university. And he was told by his father, don't go to university, because he came from a farming background. And his dad thought, no, we don't need university. So he disowned my grandfather for real when he went to university.
Yeah. Oh, wow.
He got a full academic scholarship to be able to go. And the family thought that he was almost being too, I don't know, maybe too proud or too aspirational. And I think a lot of this has to do with how much we understand it's not just drive. It's like my grandfather really loved learning, and I don't think he would have felt complete. And so he knew what he wanted, which was a form of deep desire coupled with ability. And he met my grandmother there, and that changed his life. And yeah, so a lot of this has to do with maybe being willing to follow that. And then his father came around after a while. Sounds funny, but yeah.
I'm happy to hear that. That's really nice.
Yeah.
If I'm correct, you moved around quite a lot, but importantly, you lived in Russia as a young kid. What was that move like to Moscow?
It was incredible. It was amazing. Yeah, we moved there when I was 4. I had just turned 4, and we lived there, and it was back in the mid-1980s, so there wasn't a lot of communication. You'd have to set up in advance to have a call back to the U.S. I guess just visually, if you could imagine, when you went there at that time period, what it looked like, Anne, was cars that are all, and this is from a 4-year-old perspective, cars that are all the same color, so they're all black, streets that are very wide. You have to take an underpass even when you're walking to get across the street, because they would have 5 or 6 rows of traffic going one way on one of them. So just big streets coming through the city, and the city had a lot of bravado, like a lot of hard lines, and there would be huge banners of Stalin or Lenin that were projected on the buildings so that people would know. And I learned Russian. I went to a Russian nursery school, Detsky Sad. And so a lot of this was about comfort crushing for me, and just going into languages that I didn't know and cultures. and searching for belonging, and also understanding that that political situation was different than the cultural situation, which was people still practicing a lot of the traditions that had been before communism, and having the stories and having things like the Bolshoi Ballet. All of that was still a really rich part of the culture, and I loved it, and I made friends and saw that the macro is not the same as the micro. So, you know, growing up, I'm a big fan of slow journalism, which I know Harvard Project Zero talks about. Paul Salopek has done, he's a Pulitzer Prize winning journalist who travels around and goes to areas that usually just get headlines for being violent, oppressive areas. And he'll do things like talk with a person at a farm stand, try to show that there are many different people in cultures. But yeah, so I think Russia in the 80s was a big example of that and a lesson for me in all of that dichotomy and all that mashup of stories and backgrounds that taught me to take time when I'm like, I'm never somebody who jumps to a quick assessment because I know there's so many facets.
That's fascinating. Yeah. Thank you so much for sharing that. I loved reading that in the book. So what happened next? How did you come to study what you studied? What were you like as a teenager? Fun? Rebellious? Lots of misbehavior?
Are you asking me? Because yeah, I was wild. No. So what happened next is we came back to the States, and I think that the first phrase that fell into my mind was that I fell in love with running. I fell in love with trails. I fell in love with nature. I had been in the city. If for anyone else who's learned to do something that little kids do when you're older, I applaud you because I know what it's like. I learned to ride a bike when I was almost a teenager, and it was fun to have training wheels when you were above the age of usually having training wheels. Yeah. And I love the freedom. I think for me, freedom means a lot. It's a big word. And I would go off into the woods and go running and just feel this amazement. So we were back in New England, and I ended up just really loving creativity and arts. And what was I like as a teenager? I think I was mildly rebellious. I was also really interested in learning. So I might have not classified myself at the time as a perfectionist, but I had those tendencies and wanted to do well. I'm the older child. So in my family, I think I definitely wanted to impress my parents, do a good job, and try everything. I think that's another thing. Our cross-country team in high school had this awards day where people won different awards, and the coach gave me a candle with two ends, like two wicks. What are you saying? Because I would do drama club and be in plays. I was in the debate team. I was on the math team. I really did. I was in the academic bowl. I was one of the people involved in the student council making decisions. And it wasn't because I wanted to do so much to be busy. I felt like I needed to taste everything. I wanted to taste everything, see what it was like. And then I'd get really into it and enjoy it. Yeah. Luckily I had good friends and we would all carpool with each other because my parents were still traveling a lot and people were doing different things. And yeah. And I should back up and mention, I know I've talked a lot about male figures, but my mom was a banker growing up, and she was the first woman, and she opened part of the first bank for women in New York when they started to have their own careers and they started to have their own funds. So I think a lot of my mom as well was a huge influence growing up, teaching me independence and to do things and try things and not always to see binary male female roles. So that was really interesting for me to grow up with that lens.
Fascinating. I understand that you had a very artistic streak. What ideas did you have for a career at that time?
I loved space and outer space. I think I definitely had astronaut in mind, and yet I didn't have anything that felt backwards, like a destiny. Sometimes my friends ended up living in Switzerland for a while, and my friends in Switzerland and I would celebrate Yuri Gagarin's Day, the Russian astronaut. He's beyond nationality. He's just an amazing case study too, for a life that was really dedicated to doing things before anyone else did and with discipline and also that sense of possibility. And when Gagarin knew he wanted to be an astronaut, he did everything like in a line that you needed to do. When I had a dream of the future as an artist and a scientist and a curiosity-driven person, I never labeled, I have to be this. So it's a really interesting question if I think about it deeply, because I think that I was trying to follow what felt in alignment in my body and my sensibilities. I knew I loved to write and to express and to tell stories. I was always writing in a journal, but I never said, oh, I want to be a journalist. How do I go about getting the credentials to do that? I just thought, oh, if I nourish myself doing these things, that's going to lead into a life that's going to have a label someday, being the thing that's the completeness of me, like that. Yeah, so I did want to be an astronaut, and I didn't say I'm going to start at the age of 12 being in the pre-astronaut program, which is the Gagarin route.
That's interesting. I recognize myself in what you're saying. I really wanted to sing, but I didn't really want to be a singer, if you see what I mean. There was a deep desire for a specific artistic pursuit, but there was never a clear formed idea of I want to be X. My identity was always fluid at that level.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting.
Yeah. Yeah.
Leaving room
I get that.
Possibilities.
Yeah. And can I tell you, singing is amazing.
I know.
I grew up singing. I grew up singing on the trails and being part of the choir. And then in the assemblies, sometimes I'd have solos and just sing. And singing is freedom. And I realized part of this book, I'm going to have to bring out later. We'll share research. But some of it is about the fact that we hear sound all the time, and we are, music is just an amazing wellness. There's something in our bodies that resonate with sound and music, and we are constantly tuning with the world around us. So people who sing or people who play a musical instrument, there's been a lot of research about how it connects with the brain, how it connects with the body, and how it moves us back into sort of this synchrony with the world. And sometimes I know when I'm happy, I'm singing, and I'm singing in the shower, and I think singing can be really wonderful. And again, it's one of those things where people sometimes say, oh, I'm not a singer, because we have so much stigma about the yes and the no. But yeah, so some of what I used to sing used to be making up stories and just singing and coming up with whatever the next line would be that I thought was exciting. So some of it was me. Yeah, I guess that would be like improv, not scat, but just improv, probably based on classic music from musicals, growing up listening to musicals. So I used to make up my own lines and make up my own musicals. And then in performances, I would sing things like The Rose, this Bette Midler song. I would sing that. Yeah, I love singing things that are moving and uplifting. And yeah, and then in college, this is a really great discussion because I feel like it comes from the inside out. Sometimes you can have discussions from the outside in, but this is, where is that through line that's your energy center? I had grown up thinking that I wasn't really a dancer, and I ended up singing in college as part of a dance group. I took African dance because I love drumming. Ended up learning how to move my feet and move my body, and loved it so much that I joined the more technical performance group. And then we had music accompanying it that was songs and just a cappella music. And we all were singing, and our teacher said, Caitlin, can you sing that song just by yourself? And I sang it, and the whole group was, okay. So then as part of our dance, it would be me singing a solo, which felt interesting to me because a lot of the origin, obviously, the origin is all African dance. And so clearly I felt a And sometimes it comes up culturally, okay, that's not the culture. It was a mix where I guess interracially, I was one of the few white people in the group and everybody was together and we all danced together and I learned how to listen to the stories. And then when they asked me to sing Swahili and represent that, the song was in Swahili. So I was singing it and loving it and learning to appreciate it and not feel that sense of othering that can be so dividing, but also feeling like, okay, and I also understand that I'm learning how to listen better and I'm learning how to understand more about Black history and more about everything that you dance has a story underneath it. Everything has that. So when I wanted to learn, sometimes I would take dance and I would take dance classes to learn more about the body movement and underneath it, what that was unpacking historically. So yeah, so music is storytelling and I love that so much.
It's so beautiful what you said about dance being a story. Everything underneath, if you deconstruct it, is telling a story, of course. So, university, do you want to give us like a rough idea of what you decided to study and how it landed you in the job that you have now?
It's, yes. I'm going to say yes to everything, knowing that that straight line is not really going to happen. But whose does, right? The beauty
of
life.
There are no straight lines. Hold on.
Yeah.
There are some straight lines. But
okay,
clearly, neither of us are in that camp.
Yeah. Yeah. And university was wonderful because, again, I was at a school where I could study a lot of different topics. I went to Duke in North Carolina. Having grown up in New England, it was different to be in that environment. I had a scholarship. So I was studying with the ROTC programs. I was studying thinking that I might go into the military, and it was a military scholarship. I was really interested also in being part of the negotiation strategy, that level, having parents in the Foreign Service. I was really interested in being pro-peace and being part of, I was debating, okay, do I go through a program that would have more of a track toward military flight, thinking about being an astronaut. And over the course of my college years, eyesight was not good enough to be in that program. So there was a lot of changing in my dreams and goals through that. And I'm grateful that I had all of those exposures to, say, a high-level engineering class, calculus, physics, understanding things that might not have been on a typical English major's. I just had a lot of different classes, right?
Yeah.
So when I was studying in college, I ended up doing a creative arts program and doing a lot of certificates in interdisciplinary art and studying. One of my favorite courses was studying lemurs in the wild. I love Madagascar and lemurs.
Oh, wow. They're so pretty. They're so cute.
And they're so diverse because they just had to evolve on this island where they didn't have a lot of predators and they could be very widespread in their specializations and the way that they develop is so exotic and different. And they're a female dominant species, which is really interesting to study because they have a different way of the community existing together. Yeah, so I guess that's an indulgement where you can decide to specialize in something that's not your... I'm always creating these cross-links, creating some kind of... I think there are metaphors everywhere. And sometimes when we learn one thing, we ended up kind of unpacking something in a different area. So I appreciate that.
Yeah. And I don't know about you, but I also think that when you are hard learning something like math or writing or something else, having a completely different class simulates a different part of your brain. And it's like going on holiday, even though you are learning something else. At least that's how it feels to me.
Definitely. That's how it feels to me too. Yeah. And it's refreshing and engaging. And yeah, so I got out of college, felt like I had to have some kind of career path. I felt that way, but I knew that it wasn't going to be maybe the long game because there was so much to still integrate and integrate parts of me that were still about the becoming. And so I was not pursuing anything that felt like it wasn't right. And I ended up going into computer programming and integrating that with education, making a transfer from being a programmer in an office in a cubicle to doing more curriculum design that could use some of my background in the arts and in English. And really, in this idea of how do we create expression across the curriculum? And that's what I was interested in. How do we get a curriculum that used to be separated into different areas of study and still have the depth of study and have students able to see the connections between them? So that was really formative for me when I was out of university developing a career, to be given a leadership role in different schools, to be in charge of designing that integration and bringing teachers together to talk about why are we teaching these topics in the first place? Because it's not really about content. It's about what people call a theory of knowledge. Like, how do we contemporize what has been a classical way of study in the past? And now I think things are so engaging because they're becoming more centered on the learner and having a learner say, this is what I'm curious about. This is what I want and need. And more people are serving as mentors and collaborators. I was really interested in how the brain works and when do we feel our most creative? How do we re-engage the learning process? So that was a big part of taking my education in academia and in my university and moving it into a career where I could play a role and kind of shake things up and infuse senses of humor and delight and poetry and expression. And so I went from teaching in America to teaching in Belgium, moved from teaching in Belgium to teaching in Switzerland, and then had the inspiration to found my own company, because all of that creative design and all of that storytelling and the rich kind of science and understanding the mind and how we collaborate, the importance of well-being, everything was coming alive in my experiences. So I founded my company MindWise when I was still living in Zurich. And I had a wish to reach beyond what I could do in a singular classroom. And I wanted to reach people of all ages and not only a student age population.
How did that come to be? When did you know that you were ready to make that leap and that you wanted to reach so many people?
It came about in part because when I was teaching, I would also go to education conferences and I would lead workshops. And working with adults, I saw that there was a certain connection that they had. It was similar to my students and similar to myself, needing to shed a lot of those limiting beliefs that people carry. And I realized that kind of the future depended on a systems change. So when I would do those types of talks and workshops, I would come alive too. And that was nice because it just felt right. It felt like there was that quality where I enjoy public speaking. I enjoy being with other people. And I'm an introvert and an extrovert. So I guess I'm an ambivert. And I realized that I like the content development. I love being able to translate. So if I could take my technology background and a lot of the diverse kind of skill set that I have and be a translator for others to have more access. Yeah, I realized that adults needed that too. And there were people who had grown up feeling like they were prescribed a life, or they thought that they wanted something that was a career path with a label. And then that wasn't enough. They needed to come back to community and to a more, I think a creative mindset is in all of us. And so fast forward to today, something I want to mention is that quite recently, it's come up a lot in statements like the World Economic Forum stating that the future of work depends on imagination. Imagination and creativity are important for humans. And yet we don't necessarily cultivate programmings that bring out our creativity. And I feel like my calling is to ignite people's creativity and realize that's inside of them and they have access to it. It's not forcing an output, but a lot of what led to my founding of a company was because I knew I had tools and methods that could animate somebody's deepest desire coupled with their ability to find more purpose and meaning in what they're doing. So in ways, it was natural that would come about.
Thank you. I think that I can perhaps jump to my next question because I think it's linked to what you do at MindWise. Can you tell me about how or why intention is so important to you? And whether it's in your work or in your experience design, and of course in life.
Yeah. Intention is, again, not force, but really taking a moment. I've learned that there's a lot of power in the space between the notes. The notes that we're playing are important, but the space between is actually our chance to take a breath and ground and really feel what is something uniquely human, which is our presence and our being and our understanding of what actually we are bringing to what we're doing. So we focus a lot on doing, I think, in our lives. And intention is that. It's funny because it almost doesn't have a synonym in my mind because it's so pure.
Yeah.
But it's the state right before attention. So it's right before we place our attention on something because our attention is our greatest commodity. It's how time is distributed. If our attention is on ruminating over the past or spending time in some kind of mental anguish over how to make the right decision in the future, then we're not really living in the present. So for me, there's all of this. There's so many tools at our fingertips. I have some VR equipment behind me. A lot of people know me because of my work in metaverse and in technology and in spatial computing. But the intention is the most important part. I couldn't surround myself with all of this noise if I didn't have the intention first to understand context and what I actually want to do with things, which doesn't mean that it's not evolving and that it's not emergent, because I actually think if you have intention, then you're focused more on receiving the present moment as it unfolds. So that to me is really key. And when I work with MindWise, sometimes it is in roles that are similar to coaching or similar to teaching, because I'm guiding people about certain frameworks of how they can approach this kind of technology saturated future and perform at their best.
Yeah. I'm so glad I asked that question. Intention is big in my, to me, it's quite loaded because it's something that I have been using to ground all of the meditations that I lead. I always love to start with a few deep breaths in and out and setting an intention. And the funny thing is, at first it feels a little bit performative. Oh, the teacher says I need to find an intention. But as you said, it's the moment before. It's almost like I couldn't find another word. There's no synonym. It's almost, it colors the experience.
Yeah.
If you think of watercolors and you have a little bit of water, but you just choose, the intention is that little extra input that will decide the course of the next actions. I find it's quite magical.
That's beautiful. Yeah. Yeah. And it's maybe a crouch before you leap. It's.
And it's a reminder. It's also, you've said it before, and I said it at the beginning of our interview, we do so much and we focus so much on doing. Intention is almost like that moment inward where you just check back in with yourself. And I'm not saying that we're always aligned, even when we have an intention, but by choosing to try and find one, we have more chance to create something purposeful. Whereas if we just walk around with that intention, we're unlikely to have any kind of result. And when I say any kind, we're unlikely to have the results that we may hope for.
Yeah.
Okay, so I'd like to talk about your early beginnings with VR and XR and how you are specializing in experiential design particularly around XR. Would you mind giving us an overview?
Sure. So XR stands for extended reality, and it's a continuum. A lot of people will talk about these terms and they can be somewhat off-putting for people. So I'm deconstructing some of these terms as we speak because there's more thrown in the mix by the day. So extended reality, I really like because it describes a continuum that can be augmented reality, which is putting in objects spatially that are they're layered in your physical world. And virtual reality is the other side of the spectrum where the whole world is different than this physical world. So there are different things that people might call pass-through. So pass-through is when you might put on a headset. I have some headsets behind me and you can still see your environment, but you also see some animated objects or maybe indicators that are placed on your environment to give you a feeling of context. So what I've been doing is working with a lot of spatial technology to create experiences. I've been working with spatial to create group experiences, to create individual opportunities for people to enter a world and experience something that's totally different than what they've had day to day. Let's say they come in and they might be in a garden space and they're either in a meditation session with me where we talk about storytelling and they start to build something and they create something in that world that they can then transfer back. Or they're in a group setting and they're doing something together collaboratively. I mentioned meditation because a lot of the tools that I work with, I integrate those into projects. I've worked with places like the Air Force. I've worked with places like the US State Department. I came to present at TED, which is where we met. So
yeah.
I think sometimes people think, oh, I have to work against sometimes the preconceived notions that when I describe what I'm doing in VR, I'm basically leading experiences where I teach people how to cross thresholds and work with technology. And this can be very much in a corporate setting. And the fact that I'm using some meditation techniques is because I believe that when we integrate wellness and being into the design of how we're learning and how we're using technology, it becomes not just less intimidating, but I actually think our bodies start to feel the possibility and again, the intentionality of how we're using something. So it's not just, oh, let's move a PowerPoint into VR and do the same thing that we do in two dimensions in a three-dimensional space.
That's horrible.
So tired. I'm giving you the long explanation of what I do because I love working with technology and I mostly love it because it moves people into a very curious, open state where they start to realize, oh, we're 3D creatures and we've been living in the most awkward time to be human. We've been living in a two-dimensional mediated world of screens and we can suddenly collaborate with objects and we can make this world this world in spatial technology moves people's minds into a more open state of imagination if they're guided a certain way. So I like to be that guide.
Mm. Thank you. As I was reading about what you do and reading your book, it got me to try and figure out when did I experience any kind of XR or VR in the first place. And my mind went blank. I was like, when did I? And I remember now, I couldn't find his name because I wanted to quote him. A few years ago, I was in Milan for a work trip. We were preparing a press trip for the brand I was working with at the time. And our PR manager, who was Italian, brought me to meet a friend of hers. He's an artist. We had an exhibition at a museum next to the Duomo. And he was using VR. And it was incredibly impressive. It was really beautiful. And it was fascinatingly immersive because he had created a city world where we were at the top of those crazy, amazing buildings. And there were railings in front of each of the pieces, presentations, because you really literally felt like you were about to fall to your death. But it was really wonderful. But the second time I've experienced it in a really immersive way, and I'm going to send you the link because I thought if you haven't heard of her work, you will really like it. There's a fabulous, and I mean that the word fabulous, we is justified here, choreographer, actress, and all-round fabulous human being called Blanca Lee. Mm-hmm. Blanca started her career as a dancer, and she is known for various programs that she's done in France or in Spain, where she's from. And she created this incredible experience called the Le Bal de Paris. And she built, I mean, how can I use my words? You do say quite a few times in the book and other interviews that oftentimes when people experience like really good XR, their words fail them. That's where I'm at. It was so transformative. It's 8 or 10 people in a group. We're all set with packs and we've got various, what would you call things put on our bodies.
You've got motion sensors.
We've got motion sensors everywhere, but she also has live dancers in the world with us. And it is spectacular. I mean, genuinely extraordinary. I'll send you the link. I think you guys
see. You've had great experiences.
I've had great experiences, and so randomly, because I can't remember how I reached out to Blanca, and she said, "Oh, I'm coming to Geneva. Are you free tonight?" And I was like, "Sure." And then the next thing you know, I had that headset on, the sensors on, and I was whisked off into a magical world. It was very enjoyable. I highly recommend it.
I can't wait. I can't wait to hear more and to hopefully experience that. I think it. I've been weighing a lot of, I used to always say, oh, this is not escapism. And then I recently had a student in the last week say to me, why is escapism a bad thing? Why is it bad to sometimes feel like you have an escape or something different and then you come back? I think for me, I don't see these experiences as escapes where we never want to come back or never appreciate what we have in a physical sense. Because I think sometimes people will say, are you saying that XR or being in these virtual settings that can be so transcendent, will they ever just dull us to the beauty of what is the simple, pure physical? I don't feel that way. I've had experiences being part of a Firebird dance program or going to the moon. I was describing earlier leading people in a garden space, and that's just the beginning. That's the beginning of a journey that I would lead that has integrated music and sometimes colorful interactive art. And this can be for any, again, like just imagine a highly corporate, an HR team working together, and then they end up doing something, they understand how to use the tools. And then they've also had a creative wellness workshop together. When I come back from these experiences, like the hero's journey coming back across the threshold to the physical, there's always that applied knowledge that's like a metaphor. And I will come out and just see the physical sunlight and look at the trees and feel a deep appreciation in a different way for what opportunity we have to be collaborative like this with our digital tools. I love VR. And the fact that we have these trackers now, or that we have sometimes haptics, we have a lot of different sensations that we can integrate in them that I think makes them accessible and definitely brings up a lot of curiosity in my mind about what the future is going to be.
Earlier today, I looked up to see if you were on Threads, because I see that you're on X Twitter, but I am no longer there because I just thought, And I typed your name in Threads, and I sadly have left my phone outside this room, but there was one mention of Caitlin Crowes, and it was someone who saw you at a conference 3 weeks ago, and who said that they felt generally, what's the word? Concerned about the developments of technology and VR, and that hearing you speak had completely transformed their outlook. So before we go any further, there's two things that I'd love to explore with you. The first one, and I read this today in that book of yours, Designing Wonder, is the importance of creating a safe space for people to be able to first dare go into an augmented reality or VR experience, and also to experience the wonder and awe states that you seek to create. How do you go about doing that? And how did you learn to get there in the first place?
Well, I will, first off, I'll have to go back maybe and find the threads. I trust that everything, it's that lack of FOMO. I don't feel I'm missing out at not being ambiently aware of everything or non-ambiently. It's very hard to be on social media and also understand digital well-being because I'm very good at knowing when my brain is triggered to want to scroll or want to do more. And I'm thinking, yeah, no, that doesn't really serve me. So maybe it's a superpower where I just kind of check out. I want to thank all of the friends who have been constants with me and know that we're there even when we're not mediated by the socials. Although, as Tristan Harris had said, if you stay out of the conversation completely, then you don't get to change it. So
I agree.
That's been something I'm weighing. Like I want to stay dynamically in the conversation and yet do it in a meaningful way. So pull back from what feels like empty chatter. Yeah. And I think that moving forward to your deeper question, I would love to just consider it because I think there's a lot that's about to happen and a lot that is going on in the world. And I say that because I just feel like with AI, there's so much increase in noise, but also not just empty noise in our human vulnerability. And it has to do with the way that we are curious and porous and impressionable. And I think that a lot of times I talk with my students about what it means to be open to the possible and not cynical about the world, because we can start to not trust anything. And if you don't trust anything, then you have a nice barrier, because then you can just let in what you've legitimized. But then you walk around the world without any trust in anything. And I think that could be one of the possible future scenarios. And for me, the safety is really key. When I'm hosting something or when I'm hosting an environment, I know Esther Perel talks about this a lot with the AI program of AI Esther. Couldn't there be an AI Caitlin that would just greet us in a virtual space? And if AI Caitlin was programmed really well based on all of my knowledge, she could just respond to people and host them. And then that would be so easy for me because I'd be the passive physical Caitlin that gets to just do my own thing. And I have this automated program that's so reliable, but because of course it's based on all my training data. And yet, back to why I'm very into studying wonder and awe and mirror neurons, because I'm responsive and responding in that environment to meeting people's needs. And to get into more of the granular, usually I will have met with a group beforehand, maybe even mediated over either a physical meeting or in Zoom. I do a lot of sessions with groups that are physically in person. And then we talk about the meaning of the computing and the hardware. And then people get to try and test and also move into those landscapes in ways that feel intentional and grounded and meaningful. Because the before and after for me is just as important as the during of the experience. The word safety for me is not just about, oh, let's deflect all of the possible negatives that can happen. It's also teaching somebody to be really resilient. A lot of people had told me before working with me that usually when tech doesn't work, they think that there's something wrong with them. They actually would think, oh, if a headset had a problem or if they went into a world that they were doing it wrong. And then they think, oh, I didn't grow up in that world. I'm not invited. Everyone's invited to an experience and there are always ways in many different dimensions to make it safe, manageable, and also have a level of balance and curiosity and play. I'm a really big believer in the power of play for people in their senses. I always design things with projects, passion, people, and play, and having people sense that, okay, every avatar that's human driven has a real full human with all of their emotions underneath it. So we need to be safe and celebratory of the human dignity in the experience.
Yeah, that's beautiful. And I think that what you also are very conscious of is that by creating a container that feels like a safe space to explore, people won't shut themselves off from the actual potential benefits, or benefit is the wrong word because it's not like a direct benefit, but maybe the seeds that are going to be planted by having that experience. But I'd like to ask you, and you have touched on this before, but everything that I know and I have read and understand you to be is that you are truly an exceptional experience designer. How did you train in this? And would you explain to people what that entails? Because I've had the pleasure and the benefit to train as a facilitator with some wonderful experienced designers, but you're doing it at a very high level in person and in XR. So I'd love to hear, how did you train and how could others discover this for themselves?
I'm deeply interested in the subconscious and how our subconscious experiences can shift us in different ways. And I say that because I think there's also something happening subconsciously where people come to an experience, they expect, and I like how sometimes you're reframing your phrasing, because they expect, oh, I'm going to get this. Or I'm in a corporate world a lot of times with corporate clients and they want ROIs and KPIs. And they do, they get that. And there's something else that's happening, and that's part of my experience design. But what you're teaching me, and it could be a subconscious or below, there's some frequency where I'm realizing by looking back at my own life, in the spirit of this conversation, I've come to some new understandings about things that I think I knew, but oh, there was that connection there, because it brings me a deep sense of not just joy, but meaning and alignment to be taking some of my childlike wonder or the things that I was like as a kid and come back to that and realize, yeah, that this way has been with me all the time. In this conversation, when you're asking me, how do I design for that? Or how did I become experience design, not just capable, but artful about it? It's bringing in that multitude that is me and being willing to be seen. And I think a lot of people have pushed against maybe the word authentic. I know that came up in our previous conversations. We talk about authenticity.
Yeah.
And for me, I with every word, I'm conscious, okay, sometimes these words are buzzwords. Sometimes they're heavy. But I think that what I learned through my experience design and my training is that, okay, I had in my background, talk about getting lucky, I had some of these trainings in understanding programming, understanding code. So, okay, I could speak that. And it's a language. And I also knew that, well, a friend of mine recently said, and I feel like it's important to bring it up, the fact that right now there's so many tools that let us do a lot of programming ourselves. And let's say I wanted to start a business. If it was 20 years ago, I might have to hire a bunch of people to do different things. But now there's so much that can help us do everything ourselves. But she was telling me that what she's learned is not to do everything yourself, because then you're just burning out. The fact that we can do all of it and do all the marketing and do all... No, what I learned too as an experienced designer is that my creativity and my real joy, coupled with what I think is my passion meeting purpose, is to be part of that hands-on experience design. So I like to work together with teams where, let's say I build the designs for an environment, because we're talking about something that then becomes a spatialized environment in a digital mediated world. I might need somebody else to be the sound engineer because I know the type of music I want in the experience, but I need that other person. So part of this is a relationship building over years where you start to understand through, for me, being an explorer, I go out and I try these things. I'm experiencing the different programs and part of it's hardware, but the hardware is just the surface. For me, it's about maybe planning. It's like event planning too, because you're planning how people are going to feel when they come into a space.
Absolutely. That's
imaginary in the future. So that's a lot of my experience design, of course, couples with my background as an educator and just really being into animated learning environments. And in a very pure sense, I need to release that childlike wish to be perfect. There is no perfection. There's the spirit of right now. And I think you're inspiring me. Maybe there could be a program where a lot of people might want to learn how to do some of these things and they don't know how to integrate a lot of the background and the trainings I have. I want to pass it along and tell people, this is how you get to do the things that I do, because I feel like maybe that path doesn't even yet have a name, but we're at the brink of more people wanting to have experiences in spatial computing that are beyond, let's say, picking out the movie on the Apple Store and saying, oh, I want to watch this on my headset. That's great. You can pick a movie. But what about the team building? What about the collaboration and the work that we're going to be doing in spatialized worlds and the play and the imagination? So yeah, yes and more. I could ramble on, but I think a lot of it in some couples, the science with the creativity and my experience design is often creating an architecture for experience and saying, what ultimately do I want someone to get out of this? And then it's building environments that allow for that, allow for the experience to unfold in it. So I'm always picturing either solo or group. I didn't mention emotion, but I love emotion mapping. And I know that, underneath the experiences, there are always, let's say, four. I used to have three A's for mindfulness, but four A words are always part of it. There's awareness. Mm-hmm. So awareness is going to be really rich when you're in experiences with me. There's advancement, because people are not going to be static. They're going to be questioning stories and creating them and moving. And it's a lot to do with that spirit. And there's authenticity, because I want to create safe spaces where I'm seen, other people are seen. It's non-judging. It creates that. A lot of mindfulness is about paying attention on purpose in the present without judgment. And if people can feel that sense, then that's their freedom. And then the fourth A would be agency, because it's not just a show where they come in and they watch Caitlin in a landscape. It's where they get to be the agent. Like, they get to have, and I think a lot of people are missing that agency. So the next step is going to be looking for more accessibility so that more people can access who might not have access to equipment like this. Mm.
I think now is the perfect time for you to then link this to your storytelling expertise, because you've spoken those words a few times already, but there also is an element of the hero's journey when you create an experience. And you actually have developed your own theory around it called SCUBA, if I'm correct.
Yes, that's right. We're diving. Yeah.
Would you tell us more about that?
Yeah, SCUBA. Oh, it's so fun. I know. And for me, Hero's Journey, again, is maybe a loose reference to Joseph Campbell and Christopher Vogler and some of the classic, we're familiar with the Hero's Journey paradigm. But I'm thinking of it in a different way. And so with SCUBA, it's an acronym where when anyone is having an experience, and it's, let's say that all experiences with technology involve media. It's all media. So lately, we especially need to know and be mindful of how we manage our media. And it's not just consumption, it's experience. So when I'm either leading an experience or participating in one, I'm conscious that sometimes I'm playing the mentor and mentoring somebody on a hero's journey where they play the hero. With SCUBA, the S stands for, again, setting that intention, setting your base. We're in a physical world. Sometimes setting can be as simple as a breathing practice, because going into a new environment can be intimidating. And the C is to cross the threshold. So that would be, say, putting on a headset, moving into a different landscape, starting a project with somebody else. And if I'm a mentor and I'm guiding that crossing, then I'm actually guiding somebody to understand more about what they're doing as they're entering this experience in a way that's different than just pressing a button or quickly going and saying, okay, what do I have to do right now? It's okay. Hero's journey often finds this hero a little bit uncertain at the beginning, and they need to have a little context to not feel lost. The you is when you're in the experience, you're under, you're submerged, you're immersed in something that is completely different. And that can be, for me, I was surprised. I don't know if you were, but when I was in virtual reality for the first time, I felt intimacy. I expected to feel a lot of noise and overwhelm, but I ended up feeling very peaceful. And I felt peaceful. I started to question, why am I here? And also, who am I? And all these questions of introspection. And I think that when you're in an experience, you can play with that. And I love that plasticity. People, right now, I've been working with a bunch of people working on flow states and thinking about when you're in that experience, how you can ride the ride and also notice some details that you want to take back. So that would be the B of crossing back into the physical environment is taking off the headset. It's reintegration, which would then be the A in scuba, the awareness of an applied kind of transformation. So every time you have an experience with some kind of immersive digital tool, it's not just a tool, it's a chance to go into the scuba, which is a spiraling up, where if you have guides and mentors and certain frameworks, you can then say afterwards, like you did, oh, I had this amazing dancing experience with other people and I was moving in kind of this synchronicity with them. And maybe you have some kind of epiphany, or maybe you have something that reaches you in a different way and you want to be given a little bit of time afterwards to record that and to reflect on it.
You've used the word plasticity a couple of times already. And as you say this and you come back to my own experience as I've shared it, what I can tell you is that I have a very strong and very vivid memory of these experiences because they were so immersive that they are very much encoded way more than I would have for most other artistic pursuits that would have not taken me on such an immersive experiential journey. So yeah. I do believe that you are studying neuroplasticity at the moment.
Mm-hmm. I am.
Anything fun that you found out about wonder, awe, and neuroplasticity?
Really fun things. Oh my goodness. What I love and I've learned about plasticity in particular is that it can animate us in a different way through experience. I keep thinking about experience and how our emotions are encoded in experience. And because so much I think had been treated as a cognitive kind of problem to solve. And how can we do these exercises to increase plasticity in the brain? Or how can we? And I think that for me, I love what I've been learning about surprise and delight and how our brain does seek out patterns and we learn from patterns and in ways we predict ourselves into sometimes emotions that are encoded in certain experiences by comparing them to what we've had in the past. So that's some of what I've been learning and fascinated by. And the interesting part is then if we create new experiences, we're actually creating new futures because we're creating experiences that allow us to release. That's what I'm interested in. Virtual reality, it seems to have a high similarity to the flow states that previous researchers like Csikszentmihalyi, who had written Flow, you have certain elements, but it's not so clinical. Oh, let's prescribe this in a line. But I'm saying that because I think that sometimes people get into what's the exact flow cycle for me? And they want to reach flow and they want to be in flow all the time. And I'm thinking with plasticity, let's just talk about, we could just talk about avatars for 2 hours, but it's a different form of, I have less attachment to one fixed identity. That's something amazing that XR can bring about in spatial technology, because my whole attachment to physicality can change and I can start to understand more about my somatics by paying attention to not the external, but the internal and what I'm feeling and sensing in my body state. And there's been documented loss of time, loss of as much attachment to fixed outcome as this intrinsic line of a challenge, skills, balance, and also feeling like you have some reward that you're, yeah, I'm so interested. I think some of what you'll find maybe in our conversation part two is that I'm also working in the gaming on games that infuse that level of mindfulness and that plasticity in a way that's very conscious of not being addictive. So not using the previous addictive models of game design or of experience design. We didn't bring up addiction, but by knowing so much about the science underneath it, I don't want someone to feel incomplete and that they need to come back for more or that they need to. There are certain things that you can be conscious of as a designer that actually leave someone feeling nourished, feeling enough, and feeling as if, again, back to that plasticity, that they had a reframing. Ellen Langer has great research in reframing and reappraisal. And there's so much you can do to reshape what used to be a fixed story and turn it into something where, oh, someone sees not only was that outcome not fixed in the way that they viewed it, but they have a chance now to realize all the potential in the present moment and in the future.
So interesting. I'm glad that you pointed back at this because I know that at the beginning of your book, you talk about that joke that the only two industries that use the word user is the drugs and in the gaming industry. So
Yeah.
You got me to think about a wonderful graphic in the book that talks about the depth of virtual reality. And it's true, I forgot. I think you've noticed with a lot of the science is that the possibilities for learning via VR tools are really heightened compared to, let's say, a classical experience of reading a book or watching a lecture. And the element of participation then transforms this all together and brings it to a whole different level.
Yeah, it's transformative. And just as you're saying, I think that I personally love books too for imagination and for, I like to bring up all the questions that people have given me have been, oh, and if you're feeding people the visual and the auditory, is that letting the imagination take its own shape? And I feel it's just a different way. It's not, I love books and I love that we get to make our own kind of imagination of what would be sound and what would be the visuals. And in a spatialized world, what becomes different is what evolving and what you can be a part of co-creating and some of what's happening in real time that's not exactly scripted. And when you see that, then you actually can create your own story. And I don't know if you've ever read this book, Harold and the Purple Crayon, but it's a children's book. It's really interesting. And Harold basically has a purple crayon and he starts drawing through the story what the next scene is going to be. And then he's drawing a box and then going into the box. And it's just a really provocative, fun story where you get to see, oh yeah, and I read that as a little kid. And sometimes worlds feel like that, Anne. You're just, oh, what do I actually want to experience? And I'm going to draw it right now and enter it as a world all of my own.
That sounds wonderful. Wow. Okay, I am conscious of time. Perhaps now is a good time to wrap up for this conversation. We both know we need to have at least one other conversation around all of the topics of what you're working on. Is there anything else that you want to share with us today, though? Anything that we haven't covered that you think would be timely, something that is important or that you feel is relevant to today's topics?
First off, thank you so much for having me on today, because I think we could, not only could we have many more conversations, but I see our conversation today as something that is many layers. So we're going through layers in a way that what comes up for me is just to continue to embody what I'm believing in, because as much as I can talk about digital well-being, or if I talk about being in the metaverse and feeling that having a intention is important, I do still use the word metaverse. It's a buzzword, but I think it's a spatial world that's social and storied. And that's what I would want to bring up, that these words are just pointing to experiences. And I think what comes up for me at the end of our conversation together is to remind people of the power of their own imagination and the power of their own intention. Today marks the finish line for me of writing the first draft of a book about digital well-being based on my research. So it's a celebration day. And what I've been feeling strongly is that we are existing right now in three worlds: the world of our physical space that we're sharing with other people, the world of our imagination, which we've always had, and some people want to attend to even more as they get older and work together. And that's something that I love to focus on. How do we keep imagination alive? And the third space is really this digitally mediated, connected world, whether it's going into a headset or whether it's going on to a Zoom call or whether it's talking with someone, you know, that's in another physical space. And our attention can only really be placed on one at the same time. I can't be in my imagination dreamscape and also be focused on attending to you. So it's very important, I think, not to just toggle around back and forth and bounce mindlessly from world to world. Some people right now have told me that they bought a headset, Apple Vision Pro, and they're putting a shelf in their digital space through the Vision Pro, and then they get out of the headset and they're like, where's that shelf? Where is that? Because they forget which one are we placing in which world? And are we going to end up wondering if we actually had these shared experiences or if it's in a dream that we had just by ourselves? So I'm fascinated by this. I want to close by encouraging everybody just to check in with themselves and see what feels as if it's leaving them with more energy versus feeling depleted, because some of this can leave us feeling like we're just needing a little bit of space and time. And that's why integrating well-being into this technology experience, that's why it's so important to me, because ultimately I want to have people feel like they're leaving with more than they came in with.
That's a beautiful way to wrap up the conversation. Yes, leaving with more than what they came in. That's wonderful. Now, do you have an extra 5 minutes? We are not going to go through all my closing questions, but just a couple.
I have an extra 3 minutes.
Yes. Okay.
Yeah.
Let's do this.
Okay.
What is your favorite word, one you could tattoo on yourself?
I love the word wonder. It's the first one that came up.
What does connection mean to you?
Connection means alignment, vibrancy, inside and out. And the word dignity comes up, to be in a state of dignity. Yeah, and trust. To be in connection has to do with the trust in between the nodes, because, yeah, connection is a very rich word for me, because I work to empower meaningful connection for myself, for other people too. So it's a lot of my purpose. So it does have to do with a lot of that move to a more distributed network where we're based on our connections. That connection is, again, that space between the notes that has meaning.
Thank you. And what brings you happiness?
Being fully present. Yeah. And what brings me happiness is, movement and moments of awe and wonder that give me goosebumps, playing with my dog, and music. So many things. Yeah. But I think that idea of presence, I need to have presence to be able to experience it.
Thank you so much. Yeah, my cat was trying to get me to pay attention to her moments ago. She was really giving it her all. So
I saw her on the chair and I felt like, oh, it's great to have a friendly animal in this space. I love it. Yeah.
Kristin, it was such a pleasure to talk to you today. I had a blast of a time. I already can't wait to speak to you again. So that's great news. Where can people find you if they'd like to connect and find out more about what you do?
So they can find me on LinkedIn, is one of the social spaces that I am on frequently. They can also find me on my website, caitlinkraus.com. I'm occasionally on the Twitter X space, and I do frequent other spaces like Instagram, but really just staying connected through my website. They can also sign up to find out about more opportunities to connect or news and things happening. So that's a great way.
That's awesome. Thank you so much for everything. I am so grateful for us meeting in the first place and for this conversation, and hopefully many, many more.
Thank you, Anne. It's a pleasure.
Take care. So, friends and listeners, thanks again for joining me today. If you'd like to hear more, you can subscribe to the show on the platform of your choice. And if you'd like to connect with me, you can find me at Anvi on Threads, on Instagram, Anvi Mulatalla on LinkedIn. If you don't know how to spell it, the link is in the notes. Or on Instagram at _outoftheclouds, where I also share daily musings about mindfulness. You can find all of the episodes of the podcast and much more on the website outoftheclouds.com. If you'd like to find out more from me, I invite you also to subscribe to The MetaView, my weekly newsletter where I explore coaching, brand development, conscious communication, and the future of work. That's The MetaView with two T's, themetaview.com. So that's it for this episode. Thank you so much for listening to Out of the Clouds. I hope that you will join me again next time. Until then, be well, be safe, and take care. Hey there, it's Anne again. I've got something important to share with you today. Are you struggling to connect with your audience? Feeling like your brand has lost its sense of purpose? Is motivating your team feeling like an uphill battle? Well, my passion is to bridge coaching, consulting, and storytelling to create meaningful communication and strategy that drive purpose. So let me introduce you to AVM Consulting. That's my gig, so to speak. It's my company. I offer a blend of coaching, consulting, aka advisory services, and storytelling services, all aimed at helping your brand connect authentically, rediscover its purpose, and inspire you and your team to greatness. One of the keys to success is connecting your brand to its core values. When you align with what truly matters, you attract the right clients and create meaningful, long-lasting connections. And remember this quote: the magic you're looking for is in the work you're avoiding. Sometimes the most powerful transformations happen when we tackle the challenges head on. With a proven track record of success in building incredible brands and communication strategies globally, I'm here to be your trusted partner in achieving your vision. So, are you ready to transform your brand and make some real magic happen? Don't wait another moment. Let's schedule your free exploratory consultation now and take that first step towards unlocking your brand's full potential. Now, learn more about what AVM Consulting can do for you. Click on the link in the notes or head directly to avm.consulting.